Welcome back to the Reverse Alzheimer's Summit. I'm your host, Dr. Heather Sanderson, and I'm so delighted to introduce you today to Dr. Lou Lim. He's the founder and CEO of VLight, and we use VLight every day at Marama for our residents there. And I can't wait for him to answer some of my burning questions about the VLight and also to answer yours, of course. So Dr. Lim, I would love for you to just describe a little bit about how you got into this space, how you discovered VLight and red light therapy, and what made you think to put this into a cap that people can wear on their head for brain optimization.
Yeah, well, thank you for asking. This actually goes back to in the mid-90s. I'm now in Toronto, but at that time I was in California in the Bay Area. And we were doing some technology work, LEDs, flat panel displays, for virtual reality. We were very early experimenters at the time. But what I found was with lasers, it produced some really interesting things to the body. But I actually looked at what was not really published in the English literature, but in the Russian language. At the time, a lot of the laser work was done by the Soviet bloc at the time, out of Moscow, in Estonia was part of Russia at the time. There was quite a lot of activity. So what they were doing Dan was experimenting with injecting light, red light specifically, into the blood circulatory system. And they were saying things like, it's actually improved the certain outcomes, like your recovery from diseases, your immune system is better, and, post-operation is better, and stuff like that. But actually, the first discovery published was in the mid-60s in Hungary. But it led to this. It led to quite a lot of interest in that particular part of the world. And if you know a little bit about physics and biology, and I began to ask the question, why do we need to inject light into the vein when actually red light in the infrared can penetrate through the skin? So that is a lot of, removal of intrusions, right? So I tried that, and then I asked the question: If you were to try to do it in an effective manner, you want to see where the membrane is thin and the light is able to penetrate. One of the areas that's convenient is actually the nasal membrane. So okay, maybe you can penetrate to the skin in the hand or whatever, but nasal membrane could possibly take a very safe low level, level of energy. And then I tried that and looked through the microscope and see what's happening to blood samples. And they actually improved, to cut it short. So, okay, that's a really good way to do that. But the technology wasn't available at a time to make a simple device that can be used conveniently by the everyday folks. So we had to wait till there were experiments going on. I was doing a number of other things, but it was actually in the mid-2000s. The solid state technology was good enough for me and my engineers to produce something. And we continued to do that. And we actually released pretty much under the radar intranasal devices and achieved the same thing. So we slowly, formed VLight and marketed it to the world.
Wow. So I just want everybody to know what it is we're talking about. So there's a cap that you put on your head, and then there's an intranasal clip. So you put it up, you put the light into your nose, and then there's a clip on the outside so it stays put. And then you turn this light on for about 20 minutes. And what we see is that there are potentially benefits for Alzheimer's and dementia. And so we have the privilege of talking with you today to understand all of the details about how that might be working, why we would expect that to work, what might be going on, what the mechanisms might be, and then also some of the research. So you described some of the early research, which was in lasers that were very, very expensive from what I understand. In the 90s, you couldn't get a lot of light, you couldn't get a lot of lasers. They were just so expensive. And many of them were hot. I guess there were also cold lasers, but we're talking about a pretty specific part of the spectrum of the light spectrum, and not all of it is visible even. So let's dive into some of these pieces. So why the cap? Why on the head and the nose? So you described the mucosal surfaces. Now, is any of that light actually penetrating into the brain through the nose?
Yeah, you know, we actually had our first case around 2011, 2012, with a Dutch immigrant who lived in Vancouver, British Columbia. And his family was, you know, it's like clockwork. The siblings were all getting Alzheimer's at a certain age. So he was due to have it. He was actually facing mental decline and diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. So at that time, we only had the intranasal. And presented that particular case, but we didn't publish it because it's just one case, you know. And but it, so we measured his cognitive performance. He actually improved. Because one case, you can dismiss it, okay, maybe placebo, something else happening. But this was real solid case. Today, he's in his mid-80s. He's still doing well, but he's progressed from the intranasal only to this whole headstand that you're familiar with. Now, then we did another small study that our co-authors, you know, included Michael Hamblin from Harvard at the time and Margaret Nazer from Boston University on a few cases with people diagnosed with dementia. And this was varied. We didn't filter them by what levels. And we found that at that time, we only had the neural alpha, that the first prototype that pulsed at 10 hertz. So I knew let's aim at a default mode network. I'll talk about it later with the intranasal and see what happens. Actually, the number of subjects, five of them, they actually improved. We showed the MMSE score. They actually improved significantly. So it seems to be working again, you know, small numbers. And then I thought, okay, when you study how memories was encoded, gamma began to feature more prominently around that time. So we're talking about 2015, 2016. Someone was coming out of UCSF stuff. So we did a case. Again, it wasn't published, but we did a presentation on another case at 40 Hertz. He was a professional opera singer who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And he improved. But this time we also did the measures on the EEG reading, and we found that his gamma actually went up. Now, incidentally, at the same time, towards the end of 2016, MIT published this pretty well-known, even in that field, a gamma study when they directed flickering, light flickering at 40 hertz, which is 40 times a second, in an animal study, you know, in a rat model which was bred with symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. The animals improved. They measured and found a reduction in markers of beta amyloid and stuff like that. So that was okay, it seems to converge with the other things I'm doing. I'm already developing the gamma and tested on this particular person. So that's quite enlightening. And I think from there, we kind of established, okay, everybody is saying 40 hertz. Now we're doing more experiments. We are actually doing what's happening to components of the brain, like microtubules and stuff, live cells with pulse at different frequencies. We're working with the University of Alberta, and these are like involved quantum biologists and physicists and, you know, biophysicists and people like that. We are finding some really interesting thing. We're beginning to understand more and why 40 hertz is interesting and maybe even higher.
Yeah. I want everybody to understand, when you say alpha and gamma, what do you mean? What is the difference between those two settings? So at Marama, we have the Neuro Duo, and Neuro for brain, right? So it's the cap for the brain. It includes the nasal piece, and then it's the Duo. So the Duo means there's two, right? And you can go back and forth between alpha and gamma. So I want everyone to understand, like, why would you use alpha? Why would you use gamma? And then how do you do it?
Okay. Now, before we do that, let me just briefly go through why these various components. Now, the intraneous is important. We use near infrared, so it penetrates deeper, 810 nanometers. Now, the olfactory is actually part of the brain. It has direct projection to the hippocampus, which is a memory area, the amygdala, which is an emotional area, and importantly, the thalamus, which is kind of like, you know, it does this redirecting of signals to other parts of the brain. So the nasal is important, and the other components are on the nodes of the default mode network. Now, why default mode network is a template network. When you're resting, you're not performing a task. There's some introspection. You get in and close your eyes. You get into that, and that's when your default mode network comes in. When the default mode network is healthy, it usually leads to a healthier brain. And Alzheimer's disease has been related to the health of the default mode network, depression, a bunch of other conditions, including Parkinson's disease and so on. So that's, now when you rest, get into, you know, your default mode network, you know, coming into play, actually when you pulse 10 hertz, it's actually helped, because 10 hertz is also the same kind of mode as when you get in a default mode network. You, in your alpha state, is also similar. When you close your eyes and does nothing, you're in the alpha state too. So that helps. And there was early animal study done at Harvard on animals that were simulated with, you know, traumatic brain injury, and they tried different frequencies and found that they didn't test 40 hertz, but they did alpha at 10 hertz and found that that particular pulse frequency produced the best outcomes in terms of recovery from a traumatized, an injured brain. So that led to that, you know, 10 hertz. Now, 40 hertz is now what I'm learning is not published, but I'm hypothesizing here from all the work we're doing. There seems to be a switch at around 39 and 40 hertz that kind of maybe move when you are activating the nodes of the default mode. You may be moving away from it and activating some other network that actually makes you think better. You're more alert, you know, like the Salus network, for example. So it gets into that. And in the meantime, what the MIT study did was it activated some brain cells called the microglia, which its job is actually to remove this unwanted debris in your brain and remove, you know, stuff. It's active when you're sleeping and, you know, you're activating the lymphatic system to clear stuff. What we figured, the microglia can be toxin away when it's overactivated because it causes inflammatory condition in the brain. But in this one, we are in the research field, we are believing that photobiomodulation modulation is probably activating the non-inflammatory subtype called M2. So it could be doing that, and it actually helps the microglia to help remove this, you know, the unwanted debris in the brain, which includes the beta amyloid deposits, plaques, and the tau. So that's why we often recommend that use the gamma when you're taking a nap or when you're sleeping, you actually helps it a bit more. So that's very briefly.
So gamma is the 40 hertz and then alpha is the 10 hertz. Is that right?
Yeah.
And these are pulses of light per second. So 10 is okay. So there's 10 pulses of light per second with alpha. And is that, do I understand correctly that it's amplifying your alpha waves? Is it associated with the brain waves alpha and gamma?
Yeah, it's interesting. We published a paper in 2017 to show what happens when we directed gamma 40 hertz on a healthy brain, and found that it actually elevated the power of the faster waves like alpha, beta, gamma, and reduced delta, theta. Now this is interesting because in the world of neurofeedback, you're, for many conditions, you're looking for something like this. So like when you have ADHD, even some evidence regarding schizophrenia and so on. Now this, so that, and Alzheimer's disease also can be correlated with too much of the slow waves. You know, that's why you're behaving like that, and not enough of the faster waves. So that, you know, we are able to change the waveforms too with when we direct gamma, even in healthy brains. So now with 10 hertz, based on the animal study done, of course, there are a lot of experiments that can be done, but we just use what's available, what's published and what we know, may accelerate, a brain that's been through physical trauma, like traumatic brain injury, concussion, from other sports or from blast explosions. So that it may accelerate healing based on the animal study done at Harvard. So that's why, you know, this is some of the rationale. And generally, some people report, you know, at 40 hertz, the brain is too active, too busy. And whereas we don't hardly get anything like that from 10 hertz. So generally speaking, the default, you know, the go-to frequency is probably 10 hertz. And if you want a higher functioning and you have particularly when your brain is going through some degeneration, 40 hertz is probably, you know, the device to go to.
So that's the gamma. So the gamma 40 hertz, that's more associated with help for Alzheimer's and dementia. Now we are really excited to have the alpha as well at Marama because anxiety is something that often comes with dementia. So many of our residents, they suffer, especially at the beginning when they're transitioning and getting into the routine at Marama. And so we find it very, very helpful to have that alpha mode to help to calm people down. So I'm wondering if you guys have seen the same thing and if that's in the research as well, that using that alpha state, that 10 hertz is helpful for kind of other things.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's actually, I get feedback, way from neurofeedback practitioners who often say that they prime their patients with the 10 hertz before they get into neurofeedback and they get better results. So it may be, you know, it's establishing your brain to be in a better state and become more receptive to other treatments. But, so these are stuff we are seeing. Now, I have to say that I can't go out and say, okay, for sure, we're going to treat Alzheimer's disease with any of these devices. That's why we're doing a large pivotal clinical trial that's been stymied by the pandemic for 2 to 3 years. So we kind of restarted again and try to prove it. So for now, we say we're just helping the brain to function better as a general statement.
Okay, so let's talk about those mechanisms. My understanding of the Hamblin work, you mentioned Michael Hamblin, he published with you. He was extremely prolific in publishing papers and data around red light therapies, the use of red light therapies, and some of the mechanisms. And so my understanding of those is that there's a few mechanisms that are proposed, but the one that's maybe best understood is the effect of red light therapy on activating the mitochondria and the production of ATP through, is it the cytochrome C oxygenase enzyme? And so what I understand about it is that you essentially, after using it multiple times, hopefully over time, daily or 5 to 6 days a week, you're activating the mitochondria in a way that they are more efficient at producing ATP, or the fuel that our brains and our cells run on. And a lot of us, I'm a naturopathic doctor, right? And I see patients, and often when I think about mitochondria, I think, all right, more carnitine, more ribose, more riboflavin, more CoQ10, those nutrients that are so important for mitochondrial function. And there's the red light therapy and how it works was just, it kind of like my brain had to like reshuffle thinking about what was possible and what impacts the brain and all cell function. So it speak to that a little bit and how I think it's part of like zooming out, right? What are all of the things that impact cell health? And that, you know, we do the Bredesen protocol. We think, but what are all of the things that are going to impact brain health for better or worse? And light is one of those things outside of kind of the typical box, right? The medical model of adding nutrients or pharmaceuticals or something. So I digress. Please tell us how this works.
Yeah, actually the most go-to explanation for mechanism behind photobiomodulation is the activation of mitochondria. And actually what's happening is the mitochondria becomes more receptive to photobiomodulation when it is performing suboptimally.
And photobiomodulation equals V-light. It equals this red light therapy, right? That they're synonymous.
Oh, right. Yeah. So photobiomodulation involves mainly, I say, you can explain it whatever you like, but is the effect of light on the body, on the cells, and so on. Now, it's usually red to near infrared, because the mitochondria is actually receptive to, you know, this window of wavelengths of light. So the theory is that it activates the, you know, cytochrome C oxidase enzyme in the last terminal of the electron transport chain. Now, what's happening is multifactorial. It's not just the increased production of ATP. ATP equates energy and, you know, some other things too. But one important thing it does is, you know, often the mitochondria is performing suboptimally because nitric oxide is somehow stuck, you know, it's stuck in the electron transport chain. So when it absorbs this red light, it releases this nitric oxide, and nitric oxide is a vasodilator. It gets released to your body. It does a bunch of other things too, but it is well known for helping the blood vessel walls to relax, so you get better blood circulation. Now, what it also does is there are evidence of other transcription factors. Some, you know, these are factors that can alter the proteins or alter your genes. For good and bad reasons, but in photobiomodulation is usually good because it helps release things like, you know, BDNF, which is, you know, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which helps your brain to regrow. It helps to control toxicity in your brain when your brain is, like, when your brain does anything, it does, the byproduct is some toxicity. So it helps to, you know, neutralize that. It, you know, it does to improve the integrity of the cell walls and a bunch of other things. So it's a collective thing. And what it also does is we are, and this is important for the work we do, is it seems to reduce the markers for inflammation. Now, you know, as in your practice, you see know, too much inflammation is not a good thing. Inflammation is always there when the body is trying to heal something, right? Or to deal with the immune system dealing with pathogens invading your body and stuff like that. But we see actually, just to summarize first and then go into details, Alzheimer's disease, other than the amyloid cascade hypothesis, which is, you know, which the drug companies are really going on, and the recent drug that's been showing good data, lecanemab, is focusing on the amyloid deposit and clearing it. It's got some serious side effects, but generally it slowed down the decline due to Alzheimer's disease. But the other major hypothesis is, one is the health of the mitochondria, because it does so much other than energy. And also inflammation. There's increased recognition that Alzheimer's disease is a disease of, it could be of your immune system. And there's evidence that it could be autoimmune. And this is discovered, interestingly enough, over the research done for COVID-19. You know, the brain is being seen to be for COVID, you know, the effect on the brain seems to be quite similar to Alzheimer's disease. So very similar presentations. And they did this, you know, a lot of marker studies and so on. And what is quite common is that it seems to be an increased level of cytokines, which are pro-inflammatory factors. So there's inflammation going on. There is evidence of it being an autoimmune problem. It could be because, you know, in COVID-19, we're doing a big clinical trial for COVID-19, by the way. We finished one and we're going to a long COVID study, so we understand the mechanisms here. It's not completely understood what's happening. But say long COVID, for example, the damage to, you know, to the vascular system, the microvascular system, it seems to be creating this response from the body. And when it's chronic, it seems to be lingering on. And, you know, this level of inflammation is on all the time. And it seems to be also affecting the brain. And then they compare the markers with Alzheimer's disease, the presentations are similar. So it could be, it could be a inflammatory disease. So there's more research. Actually, a lot of this work is coming out of in Canada, at the University of Toronto. They're trying to find a cure for Alzheimer's by looking at the inflammatory factors. So now, if you look at photobiomodulation as a method, as a science, and on its mechanisms, there's quite a lot of discussion about how photobiomodulation, obviously mitochondria activity, and also helping with reducing these too high levels of inflammation. So that's, you know, that's how the
for me, I always wonder when someone is talking about inflammation, of course, the V-Lite is helping to clear it out, but I also wonder if it's helping at a level to prevent inflammation, right? Because when there's inflammation, it's usually in response to something. So my question is always, well, why the inflammation? What triggered that? And certainly in the case of COVID-19, we could say, oh, well, it's a virus. And I think in Alzheimer's, we can point to things like herpes is associated with the production of beta amyloid plaques and other inflammatory markers that are associated with cognitive decline. And so it's interesting to start connecting those dots and say, well, V-Lite is going to help no matter what the cause of the inflammation is, right? We're going to reduce some of that by getting it out, by helping the mitochondria produce more energy and work in all of the ways that they work, so that there's just more efficient metabolism and processing in the brain at the level of the mitochondria and then at the cell. So very exciting stuff. And when we talk about, you know, certainly part of the reason why I was very quick to bring VLite into Marama is because the risk is so low. Essentially, it's cost and time, right? And at Marama, we have the luxury of being able to spread the cost over the 12 people who live there. And so we can diffuse some of that. But the risk is so low, really, compared to so many of the other things that are typically available for people. And then also, what we see is, you know, of course, we know that exercise is one of these modifiable risk factors, that diet is a modifiable risk factor, sleep, there are lots of things. And as people progress through the process and the degeneration associated with Alzheimer's, it's harder and harder to get them to engage in those behavior changes that would be so beneficial. And the VLite is something that we can just put on. It's very passive, right? And so we have had residents and participants in the clinical trial at my office who use the VLite. And even when they're in those later stages, we certainly anecdotally notice benefit. And even in that day, right? I mentioned the reduction in anxiety with the alpha. And so that's part of why we've incorporated it so quickly in our program. Also, of course, the research that you've been pointing to that it is very much evidence-based. So I'm curious, are there any side effects or any risks that maybe I'm overlooking?
Well, we've got tens of thousands of devices around the world. We hardly hear of any serious side effect. Some people, when they use the VLite device, they experience a mild headache in the beginning. Maybe there's some adjustment happening, but after the first treatment, it's not there anymore. So that's a good thing. Now, one thing about trying to understand why, about treatment and the level of energy you're supposed to deliver. Why do we often say, okay, for a normal healthy person, you don't need to use it more than once every 2 days or so. If you have a condition, you can use it every day. Try to take 1 day off from treatment. Now, the reason is...
Yeah, why?
Now, one of the things, one of the markers that's produced by photobiomodulation is just like everything else, once you do have some activity, you produce some level of reactive oxygen species, which is a free radical. And you can imagine if you keep pumping, well, the free radicals is good. At a low level, it stimulates an immune response. Now, if you keep doing it too much, there is a danger of coming to a threshold where the effect plateaus off. And you keep doing it, it might get into a negative effect. So this is the biphasic response in photobiomodulation that's also discussed. So you want to do, to have the right energy, but not too much of it. So that is, we haven't seen people using a lot and getting this problem, but we want to prevent it if possible. So that is, it's also convenient because, okay, all you need to do is if you have a condition, you want to do it once a day, it shuts off automatically after 20 minutes. You can do all your activity. I use it when I go to sleep, I just put it on and just slumber off. Different people do it differently.
And, if we have people do it while they're meditating.
Yeah, I can talk about meditation if you want. there's a lot of stories behind it too. Now, it just does that and that's it, so I don't know people really keep doing it continuously. I'd say there is a possible risk in trying to do that. All you need is just a certain amount of energy and that's it.
So it also helps with circadian rhythm. Do I understand that correctly? Because red light, I always think back to like, okay, our hunter-gatherer ancestors, they were exposed to that red spectrum in the morning during sunrise and then at sunset. And is there some degree, like, does that make sense to you that we're sort of approximating that? And would it be helpful to use the VLite more in the morning or more in the evening, like around sunrise or sunset to help with that circadian rhythm?
Yeah, we've had, I'd be interested to do a sleep study, but we've had reports of people using the red, like 10 hertz in the evening, it actually helps to go to sleep. There is evidence that red, actually this published quite a number of years ago, when this athletes in China were exposed to red, they actually increased the level of melatonin, which, you know, which is a sleep hormone. Yeah, that could be helpful. But some people say, oh, put a gamma, especially in the beginning, my mind is too alert, so that didn't help with sleep. So, but I tried 40 hertz and I still went to bed, so I might be different, I have no idea.
Maybe gamma in the morning and alpha in the evening?
Yeah, but I'll say just use once a day is enough for most people, or once every 2 days.
Okay,
either got one. It.
Either one. Okay, so not using them both in the same day, using one or the other.
But you can experiment. It's not going to harm you too much and see how you feel. You know, if it's you might find that if you keep doing that, you I don't know what it's going to be like. You might experience a little bit of fogginess or something. I have no idea.
But, might be too much.
Yeah.
Interesting. So you had mentioned before we started recording something really interesting. I'm so excited to learn is that the positions of each of the lights on the cap, on the helmet kind of device. It's not a full helmet. I don't want to give anybody the idea that it's a full helmet, but it's this device that you wear almost like a hat, and then plus the nose clip, that each of these sites are very intentional, very thoughtful and important about where they are and why. And you were talking about the default mode network. And then also that the nasal one is going into the amygdala, the hippocampus, and the thalamus. Now, are there other parts of the brain, like parts of the cortex, that are associated with vision or sensation or anything like that that you're targeting? Or is it just this default mode network?
Yeah, we first of all, we try to make it simple and comfortable.
Yeah.
Now, there's one very important thing that we try to do. It may not, you know, at this moment, it may not be perfect for everybody, but we try to have contact on those particular spot while we make it convenient. Now, we measure everything. You know, we measure what energy, what power you want to deliver over what period of time. So it's a matter of dose. Now, to be predictable is when you have contact and when you are, that's why we design in such a way where it's not one full helmet, because everybody's head is different. Right. If you try one of those fixed size helmets, with those bigger heads, you actually not, you know, it's just up there. And when you have small heads like children, it wobbles and stuff. So it's not stable. Now, the big difference is this. If we are able to have contact, the amount of energy is predictable. The further you are away, actually the attenuation is squared by the distance. That's physics, the inverse square law. Now, the problem with this fixed size helmet is, first of all, there is, you know, this circuit board in there with the LEDs. They got to keep away from contact, so there's a film, just to protect and not make it too hot. So there's quite a lot of distance. And we measured what is landed on the scalp. You want it to be like here is 75 hertz, is 100, you know, but the nose is nine milliwatts. Now, first of all, the LEDs that we use are customized for us. So the manufacturer for LED does this LED just for us, that you can go to a very high and be able to control with a micro circuit board. You know, it's intelligent, there's small circuit boards everywhere. Now, I limit it to 100 because for safety reasons, they go too much. If people use it too much, it could be higher than the threshold for people. It's kind of like when you go out to the bright sun, which is what, you know, we are evolved to be able to handle that level of power. And most companies out there can only get LEDs until recently about 23 milliwatts. So it's pretty low power. Imagine you're away from that, hardly any power touches it. I don't know what the number is. I say it's very, very low. Okay, I'm just surprised it does anything. So we are very careful about the engineering. The level of precision as much as we can. So we are continuing to do the research and maybe we'll improve the comfort and form factor. And because of that, okay, we do not have a lot of LEDs. And for reasons that we want to have maximum effect with comfort, right?
I see. Yeah. Okay, so it's not about covering the entire head. It's really about being specific and targeted about where it's going, making sure that it's comfortable.
Yeah, and you have enough energy delivered. You have a lot of LEDs that's not as far away from your head. There's not enough power to do anything.
It's not going to penetrate into the brain where you want it to do the work.
Exactly.
Right, okay. Yeah. So what's on the horizon for you at VLight, and also just like new discoveries, and particularly as it pertains to Alzheimer's and dementia?
Well, we are going to restart our clinical trial, which is a big task. You know, we're looking to recruit about 220 patients and do a double-blind study. And this time we might be revising our protocol to, this is an opportunity since we were stopped, you know, for reasons beyond our control. Okay, let's find a good reason to restart. So we're developing a new device, a new version, easier to do a double blind study. We may add one more module to the head. You know, at the moment, the neuro as an accessory is optional. The X plus to the head can add to the back. So that could be added into the clinical trial. And we are going to do a like-for-like comparison with the drug that's getting a lot of publicity. This is our chance, you know, to say, okay, this drug is getting all this outcome with side effects. Let's see how we do, right? Follow the same protocol and see, okay, you guys showed a slowdown of decline by 27% over 18 months. We have some early studies that show maybe we could do some reversal, which is a totally, you know, new level perspective, you know, for the whole thing. So, and I believe that there won't be any side effects. You guys have microbleeds, you have swelling in the brain. For them, I think like 12% have swelling. Two people died in a phase three study. Like 17% of microbleeds. So I think we won't have any of this stuff. So I think it's a good chance for us to do a clinical study and like for like and see how we compare. So that's coming up for Alzheimer's. But we have a big long COVID study being planned. We hope to start. A lot of this will probably start in the first quarter of next year. We have a bunch of results waiting to be published. There are some papers independently done for traumatic brain injury athletic performance. There was a paper published by, I can say it now, the Italian researchers for autism, some really good interesting results using the duo, actually, you know, alpha in the morning and gamma in the evening. We're doing meditation study, which is super, super interesting. Long-term meditators able to switch, you know, at a certain frequency, switch into an altered state, state of bliss, like the snap of a finger. Athletic performance and, yeah, quite a lot of things. But we're also doing fundamental research, like I mentioned, well, maybe to you personally, the effect on microtubules, which are components on the brain, and see how the various frequencies are affecting. And I see that in the next couple of years, we will be more and more able to customize treatment for a specific condition because we understand the brain better. So we have the NeuroPro, which is is a sophisticated version. That does, you can change parameters and does a bunch of things, but you got to understand, brain waveforms to appreciate and use it better. But we're using that to experiment on the meditators, see if we can elevate brain functions.
How amazing. So you guys are focused not only on the mechanisms and like the basic science of how is this working and describing that, but also very much on the outcomes of how are people doing? What is their experience of life when they use this intervention, which is so much more important, at least in my opinion, than surrogate markers, like how many plaques or tangles are present, but more on like, what are people experiencing? What is the state of their disease and how do they function in the world? Whether it's autism, or an infection like COVID or dementias and Alzheimer's. So really, really exciting stuff and clearly helpful across all of them because it's supporting the cell function. Fundamentally, you're supporting cell function. And in a way that is very safe. So I hope everyone can understand why we've incorporated this for all of our residents at Marama. And we'll certainly tweak it a little bit after this conversation. And I, with me learning more directly from the source, it's such a privilege and pleasure to connect with you, Dr. Lim. Thank you so much. I want to make sure everyone knows how to find out more about VLight.
Oh, well, go to the website, VLight.com. There is, I don't keep up with my own website, but I know that, you know, quite a lot of science being explained. We tend to get a little bit too scientific, but I guess, you know, and just read what and absorb whatever you can, because we're just doing a lot more. We have a lot of researchers and scientists in the team. I think there are more researchers than other jobs in the company. And we collaborate with numerous universities. We're talking about top universities and top people in this field. We also collaborating with people not even in this field. You know, there are some other fields that we think we can use that to understand this, this modality.
It's exciting. Really fun and exciting stuff. Yeah, so VLight is VIELIGHT.com. And if anyone's kind of confused and wondering what we're talking about because you can't see it, head straight to the website. There's a picture of a woman wearing it right on the front page, and it'll make perfect sense, everything we've been describing, once you see that. And it's great.
Give me 1 second. Let me get my...
Oh, yeah. Show everyone. It's very easy to use. You just put it on, and as Dr. Lim was describing, it's relatively comfortable. And then there's the clip into the nose, and turns off.
I should have been more prepared.
No, you're perfect. It turns off automatically, right? You just turn it on, and then it turns off automatically after 20 minutes.
So what you do is just put it on like this.
Around the ears.
Yeah, and then.
And over the head.
The nasal piece. That's it. You press the button and it comes on.
And voila, it's on, helping you heal your brain.
Shuts off automatically after 20 minutes.
Yeah, you don't even have to think about it. It'll shut off automatically. You just have to remember to take it off. We love that people can multitask. They can meditate. So somebody told me she chops vegetables while she's wearing it. So lots of things that you can get done at the same time. And it's easy to do, very passive. So for people, you know, if you're struggling to get a loved one with dementia to exercise more, or, you know, eat a ketogenic diet or whatever it is, that other components of the Bredesen protocol, this is one of those things that's pretty easy, relatively accessible for people to do. So again, Dr. Lim, it's just been an absolute pleasure having you here.
Well, thank you for having me on. I hope people will understand this better. And yeah, if you can always write to info@vlight.com, and someone will answer if they don't have it. I'll respond.
I can speak from experience. I have emailed info at VLight before, and everyone has been so helpful and supportive. And you guys, you really have a great team over there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the work that you're doing.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be on this.